These ghouly moolies. They should be ghouly moolies. They look creepy enough to have a name like that.
You know what that sound means. It's time for the Michigan DNR's Wild Talk Podcast. Welcome to the Wild Talk Podcast, where representatives from the DNR's Wildlife Division chew the fat and shoot the scat about all things habitat, feathers, and fur. With insights, interviews, and your questions answered on the air, you'll get a better picture of what's happening in the world of wildlife here in the great state of Michigan.
Welcome to Wild Talk. I'm your host, Rachel Leitner, and with me today is the fabulous Hannah Schauer.
Hello, Rachel. Are you ready to get spooky?
A spooktacular episode? Absolutely. It's going to be fantastic.
Yes. Now, to celebrate the spooky month of October, we're going to talk with Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center about a mythical Michigan creature and the history of its folklore, the Michigan Dogman. And later in the show, we'll answer some of your questions from the mailbag. And sometime during the episode, we will also be revealing the winners of our Wild Talk podcast mugs. And you could find out how you can win one, too.
We'll also be talking with Karen Sexton to hear about the fall wildlife work going on in the Upper Peninsula. But before we dive into those updates, let's start things off by shining our wildlife spotlight on the star-nosed mole.
The star-nosed moles are fascinating little mammals and are easily distinguished from other moles by their small fleshy tentacles on their hairless snout. The star-nosed mole is only about 6 to 8 inches long, and like other moles, has large front feet formed specially for digging. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a mole before, but their fur is short, velvet-like, super, super soft and glossy looking. So I think they're very pretty little mammals, despite their fleshy tentacles.
The fleshy tentacles gets the best of me, frankly. There's something eerily creepy about a mole that has 10 fingers on the tip of its nose, but it's a unique species we have here.
Yes, and it's fitting for the spooky podcast then.
It certainly is. The star-nosed mole has a longer tail than most other moles and interestingly uses its tail to store fat in late winter in preparation for the breeding period, because breeding is an energy expensive activity in the late winter, early spring when it's still really cold. So they use their tail to build up extra reserves.
In North America, the star-nosed mole has a range that extends the furthest north. So in Michigan, you can find this species in the Upper Peninsula, whereas the eastern mole, which is the other mole species we have here in Michigan, is limited to just the Lower Peninsula. So as far as North American mole species go, the star-nosed mole is the one that can survive furthest to the north, which I think is interesting too.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. They also prefer wet soils, so you're likely to find these star-nosed moles on the edges of swamps, lakes, or streams. And unlike other moles, the star-nosed mole often forages above ground, and so it has longer legs to allow for easier movements on land. These moles do dig shallow tunnels in the summer and will use deeper tunnels during the winter. It also wouldn't be unusual to see a star-nosed mole visit the surface during the winter or see it burrowing through the snow.
I'm glad you mentioned that they prefer those wet soils, because another interesting tidbit that I found out about star-nosed mole is they sometimes will spend a fair amount of their time underwater. So if you see a mole swimming around underwater, that isn't unusual. You might even see one swimming under the ice in the wintertime. They're active year-round.
Star-nosed moles can be found under the water eating aquatic worms, leeches, and may also eat larvae of aquatic insects and maybe even small fish every now and then. They don't stay underwater for long, typically only a few seconds at a time. And if the star-nosed mole doesn't have access to open water, it will prey heavily on earthworms. Delicious.
Yeah, I'm just glad they like to eat leeches.
It's good to know we've got some critter feasting on them, keeping them in bay.
Absolutely. Now, those tentacles on the mole's nose are highly sensitive and are always moving and detecting objects around the mole. And as you mentioned, there are 10 pairs of the tentacles on the snout, And there's also one smaller pair just above the mouth to help the mole determine edibility of objects it encounters. And the tentacles are just as effective underwater. So if you'd like to think of it this way, they can smell underwater. They might be creepy to you, but they're very handy.
A litter size of about 5 young are born in April or May, and the young will be independent after just 30 days. The primary predator of the star-nosed moles are owls, as well as foxes, weasels, and skunks. And while in the water, large fish, such as largemouth bass, northern pike, brown trout, as well as bullfrogs, are known predators. I would have guessed that a bullfrog is about the same size as a star-nosed mole, so it's interesting that they predate on them.
I think bullfrogs eat a lot of things that are seemingly too big for them. There's some weird food items. We should cover them sometime in the spotlight section. We can dive into that.
Yeah. All right. Book note that. Book note bullfrogs for later.
Got it.
Well, these moles are extremely fascinating, and I'm glad we've talked about them. And I hope that when folks find this interesting critter in their yard, now they'll know what the strange mole is with 10 pairs of fleshy tentacles on their hairless snouts are. Stick around, folks. Next up, we'll be talking with Karen Sexton about what is going on up in the Upper Peninsula this fall.
Pure Michigan hunt applications are on sale now. If you want your shot of what is considered Michigan's ultimate hunt, pick up a $5 application or two. There's no limit to the number you can buy. If you're one of the three lucky winners, you'll get a hunting prize package worth thousands, as well as licenses for elk, bear, spring and fall turkey, antlerless deer, and first pick at a managed waterfowl area for a reserved hunt. Purchase anywhere hunting licenses are sold or online at michigan.gov/PMH.
Welcome back to Wild Talk. Joining us today is Karen Sexton, the Field Operations Manager in the Upper Peninsula. Thanks for taking some time to chat with us today, Karen.
Yeah, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So I hear that there's a cooperative program with MUCC and Caterpillar Incorporated that wildlife staff have been working on this fall. Can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
Yeah, so MUCC and their on-the-ground projects, their coordinator had reached out to us looking for a volunteer opportunity in the Menominee County area. And wildlife staff working out of the Escanaba Customer Service Center worked with that coordinator to find a project within what we refer to as our Berg Farm property, which is on County Highway 360 east of Daggett. And the focus was to do some tree and shrub plantings and provide volunteers an opportunity to bolster some of our work on the state property.
Will the trees and shrubs that are being planted benefit any particular species of wildlife? Like, is there a target species you're trying to improve the habitat for?
Yeah, so that particular property is popular for pheasant hunting. We cooperate with a local pheasant club, Menominee County Pheasant Club, and they stock the property with pheasants. And so these mass plantings will help those local populations, as well as folks go to that area to do some turkey hunting. And, you know, it also provides all sorts of other bird species a mass source as well.
That sounds like a great spot for people to spend some time this fall. If they were curious about specifically where the area was or how to find more information, is there any place they could go or an office they should contact?
Yeah, it'd be best to contact the Escanaba Customer Service Center. And I will say that that property is growing in popularity over the last couple of years. And so, you know, last year in 2020, we certainly saw an increase on public lands in general. And last year's pheasant opener was no exception. There were quite a few cars stocked in a very small parking area and a lot of hunters. Hunters still reported like being able to spread out across the property and having a really great time. And there wasn't much interference. But I just think that folks should know that if they go on those opening days, the Menominee Pheasant Club does a great job stocking throughout this season, as opposed to just one push in the beginning of the season. So hunters can still continue to find birds after that opener. So.
And out of curiosity, are there other publicly accessible hunting lands anywhere near that area? So if you got out there and there was a ton of cars and you really couldn't find a place to get away, could you go to an adjacent state game area or state wildlife area, anything like that?
Just down the road to the west, actually, that same local club purchased a couple of properties that were township properties and will remain as publicly accessible. And they're not sort of signed very well. They're kind of difficult for folks to find. But again, if you contact the Escanaba Customer Service Center, the wildlife team there can help direct you where to go. But that's it for publicly accessible pheasant hunting opportunities in the UP. It is kind of unique in a small niche.
Well, awesome. It's so cool to hear that a hands-on partnership project is happening up there to benefit pheasants and hunters. So thanks for sharing that, Karen. Are there any other projects that might impact visitors to game or wildlife areas in the Upper Peninsula this fall?
No projects going on. Staff are working really hard to sort of wrap things up so that hunters can have ease and access of public land during that busy hunting season.
Yes, it certainly is the busy hunting season. So we especially appreciate you joining us today and giving up a couple of minutes. I know you are a busy person up there. So thanks so much for joining us and letting us know what the UP has going on. It sounds like there's a ton of great work happening for wildlife. All right, folks, well, don't run away. Next up, we will be talking about the mysterious Michigan Dogman.
If you're looking for a fun, free outdoor adventure for the whole family, visit michigan.gov/elk and download your elk viewing information sheet from the Elk Resources section. Then, guided by your elk viewing map, fill your tank, grab your binoculars, and load up the family to head out to the elk range in Michigan's northern lower peninsula. Don't miss out on seeing Michigan's majestic elk or hearing their bugle echo through the fall air. Visit michigan.gov/elk to plan your elk viewing adventure.
Mythical creatures are certainly a fascinating topic and seem quite fitting with Halloween coming up later this month, when you're likely to see all kinds of ghouls and goblins out trick-or-treating. In the spirit of Halloween, we thought it'd be fun to talk about a mythical creature with folklore originating right here in Michigan, the Dogman. Today, we invited Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center on the show to talk about the history of the Dogman story. Welcome, Rachel, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into this wonderful folklore of the Dogman, would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and your role in the History Center and what got you interested in studying history?
Sure. So my title is the Education Specialist with the Michigan History Center. So it's a pretty broad topic, but mostly I am responsible for K-12 education content. So our online education materials and then the exhibit materials. So that is sort of my focus. I'm a certified teacher in Michigan, and I taught middle school for 12 years before moving over to the museum. So that's sort of my background. And my interest in history probably is from my mom. My mom, for some odd reason, knows everything about everything. And so that is sort of where my interest came from. So,
you know, I imagine with the Dogman being a creature from stories and legend, it's not one that there's a lot of detailed information on. But from the stories that have been shared over time, what is the Michigan Dogman said to be?
The Michigan Dogman is said to be a mix between a man and a dog that stands 7 feet tall, has very large teeth, colors of eyes change. It's either blue eyes or yellow eyes. So depends on which one you run into, I suppose. And he lives in the woods of Michigan and appears to campers and hikers and anyone that happens to be sort of in the woods. But that's about all we know about what the Dogman dog person looks like.
Interesting. So not a lot of detail per se, but
nope.
from, you know, some of what we've read, you know, that 7 foot tall seems to be fairly consistent, and then human body, head of a dog, or so it's an interesting description. And I mean, 7 feet, that's pretty big.
He's a tall guy.
Yeah. So where in Michigan did the folklore of the Dogman originate from?
Some of the original stories are coming out of supposedly out of Wexford County and during the logging era. So the late 1880s, there are stories of some of the loggers in the woods of Michigan who report to see different things. But this dogman mythical creature appears in some of the folklore of that era. And then it just sort of grows from there. So Wexford County to start, sort of upper lower Michigan, and then some of it into the UP. But that's sort of where his story starts and then just continues on for 140 years from there.
How fascinating. Do you at the Michigan History Center get those inquiries from folks?
We do get a few, not necessarily about Dogman, but what we end up having are people who think they either saw something in the woods or have heard stories of maybe not mythical creatures, but the large cat stories for a long time were what people were interested in, but just anything they can't quite explain from the woods. And so they come in looking for newspaper stories. The Library of Michigan has, which is a different department than the Michigan History Center, but they have a very large newspaper collection. And so people go there looking for newspaper stories. And actually, people do come into the Archives of Michigan looking at Department of Natural Resource records in both wildlife and conservation reports, or conservation officer reports, just to see what people have reported over the years, if it made it into a report, and what it says. So we do get people who come in and look at those older reports from conservation records.
Interesting. Are they just looking for any mythical creatures, or is it Dogman specifically?
We do get some people, and I don't work directly with the archives. I work closely with them, but I'm not part of the archives. But they do get people who come in looking for Bigfoot. Bigfoot's a big one. There is a Bigfoot Society in Michigan. Actually, there might be more than one. And so people come in for stories of Bigfoot or something similar to that. And then just any other, you get those local legends, especially in northern Michigan, towns that were and still are pretty sparsely populated and were very wooded. So there was a lot of sort of empty spaces and a lot of wildlife up there. So they do come in looking for reports of not always something specific, but I suppose if I pick a specific one, Bigfoot does get some attention.
I'm sure that Bigfoot, you know, has a lot of lore and from all over the country. We just thought the Dogman being originated here in Michigan would be kind of fun to talk about. So besides just the kind of the initial reports, have there been any other like particularly interesting stories that have caught your eye about the Dogman over time, or are they all pretty similar? Like, oh, we saw a mysterious creature off in the distance. It looked like a giant.
So I suppose the most interesting stories came about in the 1980s, and in 1987, apparently Dogman shows up in years ending in seven, so about every 10 years he appears. That was the original sort of thinking behind why he's so elusive, is he's doing something else or somewhere else in those other years. But in 1987, a radio disc jockey from Traverse City named Steve Cook wrote a song about Dogman and sort of brought up the story on air, and it was a joke sort of for Halloween. But then he starts getting reports from people who are just insistent that they saw Dogman or something like it. And so that sort of really took off in the late 80s. There's also a video film, an old film it's a fake, and the people that created it acknowledged that it was fake, but it was actually really well done. It was supposed to be a kid whose film, it looks like the 1970s, and he's filming out the car window when he's on a vacation with his parents, and the camera pans past something in the woods. And so that also was really, actually, as I said, it was a well done fake. So that one's really fun to watch. So I guess those are the two that stand out, is Steve Cook who I think he's still around. I think he still lives up north. And then this other film. So those are the two that I liked the best.
That's fun. A great way to get yourself spooked out for Halloween is watching those creepy videos of supposed dogman sightings. That's really fascinating about the radio song and just kind of spurring, kind of, I guess, reigniting people's interest in the folklore.
Yes. And Dogman, from my understanding, so I grew up in the Lansing area and I'd never heard of Dogman, just was never any of the folklore of my upbringing. But I have coworkers who grew up further north and they're like, oh yeah, Dogman. So it's very regional too, which I found really interesting and fascinating that something could be quite so regional in Michigan and just never made it down in the southern lower peninsula, because I'd never heard of it. And as I said, I have coworkers from up north who are like, oh yeah, totally. So I don't know. That was fun.
It is fun. I had never heard of it either until we started talking about this episode. And so for it to be so prominent in such regions and, people swear they've seen it, they have all these reportings of it. It's just, it's amazing. Especially being in a state where we have so many, we do have the woods and the natural setting. Like, it's easy for these kinds of folklores and mythical creatures to come to fruition. And it's fun, if nothing else. And so for those of us who want to learn more about Michigan's historical folklore and similar types of stories, where would you recommend we start?
I think for the folklore part of it, local newspapers, especially the smaller ones. As I said, the Library of Michigan has a great collection on site. So theirs isn't digitized, but the newspapers.com, which is a pay service, those you can look up local newspapers. And just start there, even if they're little blurbs or, that's sort of where I would start. And then, as I said, people do look in conservation records. Those are, I don't want to say difficult to access, because they're not difficult to access at all. It's just you have to sort of know a time period or what you're looking for with those. So conservation reports and wildlife reports and conservation officer reports. Those can be kind of fun. And those are in the Archives of Michigan, which is open to limited research hours. But if you go to michigan.gov/MHC, you can see when they're open, and there is an online form to sign up for a research slot. So
speaking of the History Center, I know we have the History Center in Lansing and various historical sites throughout the state. Will there be any October programming or maybe any spooky Halloween themed programming coming up at the History Center or any historical sites that folks might want to check out this month?
Our probably biggest program coming up is Archaeology Day. And so that is October 23rd, and it is at the Michigan History Center. So that is in downtown Lansing. It's a free program and it's open to the public. So people can come in and learn about some of the archaeological projects that are going on throughout the state. Some are university based, some are state government based. And so that is always a large event that we host every year. And then our individual field sites, which there are 10 of them. So we are a museum system of 10 sites, including the downtown Lansing Museum. So some of those are doing individual short sort of programs. They are continuing with school groups, and we're ready to kind of get going after a long hiatus of programming. So
so if anyone wants to find out about the programs at any of the historical sites or maybe a schedule of upcoming programs and events, where might they go to find that?
Again, it's our .gov website. So it's michigan.gov/MHC. That stands for Michigan Historical Center. And on there, we have individual pages for all of our field sites, and there is a calendar of events.
Well, thank you, Rachel. We really appreciate you sharing some of the stories that kind of surround the Michigan Dogman. Hopefully we didn't scare anyone away, because in just a bit, we'll share some tips for a wildlife-friendly Halloween. But before that, we'll answer some questions from the mailbag.
Did you know that you can take your hunting and fishing regulations with you wherever you go? Have access to the information you need, when you need it, right on your smartphone. Just visit michigan.gov/DNR digest to download the applicable hunting digest before you head out to the woods, or the Michigan Fishing Guide before you hit the water. Download the most up-to-date regulations available today at michigan.gov/DNR digests.
Welcome back to Wild Talk. Now let's dig into the mailbag and answer your questions. One, two, three. First question on the docket today is from Albert. Albert asked if there's any information on the pheasant releases that were planned for the 2021 season. So as a reminder, newly this year, there is a $25 license that's required for all pheasant hunters 18 years of age and older. If you're planning to hunt pheasants on any public land in the Lower Peninsula or on lands enrolled in the Hunting Access Program, the money that comes from this new license will be used for the purchase and release of live pheasants on state-owned public lands with suitable habitat for pheasants. Releases will be conducted during the regular pheasant season, which occurs from mid-October through mid-November, and you can find information on the 2021 pheasant releases, where they're happening, and additional details on the new pheasant hunting license on pages 67 through 69 of the 2021 Hunting Digest. There also will be information regarding the 2021 pheasant releases available at michigan.gov/small game. And Hannah, did you have any questions for us today?
I surely do. Jenna asked about hunting and what other activities are allowed on commercial forest lands. Commercial forest lands are open to public foot traffic for hunting, trapping, and fishing. But any other activities would require landowner permission. Now, commercial forest land information is available at michigan.gov/commercial forest. And here you can find maps and information on the hunting and fishing on those commercial forest lands. You can also find contact information for local foresters, and they might be able to assist with any additional questions you have about commercial forest lands, such as what activities are allowed there. So be sure to check out that page for all the commercial forest details.
I had another question. It is the fall hunting seasons now, and so some folks are heading into the woods for various species. John wrote into us, and he's planning to put a tree stand up on state land for the oncoming deer season, and was wondering what contact information he has to have attached to that tree stand if he's planning to leave it overnight. You can put up a tree stand on state land, but it must be portable and have your name and address, complete Michigan's driver's license number, or a DNR sport card number affixed to it. It all must be in legible English, and it must be easily read from the ground. So Sharpie with big letters is probably your best way to go. But it must be permanently affixed. So wind, rain, it has to be able to weather those kinds of conditions and not fall off. And remember, if you are putting a tree stand up on state land, it cannot be affixed or attached to any tree by using nails, screws, or bolts. However, a T-bolt or a similar device supplied by a tree stand manufacturer can be used. But screw-in tree steps are illegal to use on public lands, and it's unlawful to use any item that penetrates through the bark of the tree while constructing or affixing the device to the tree. So nothing that is going to injure the tree in any way can be used on state land. And Hannah, do you have a final question to close out our mailbag segment today?
I do indeed. Faye asked if there was a way to get your deer tested for CWD during the bow season. And so if you'd like your deer tested for CWD outside of the time frame when deer check stations or drop boxes in your area will be available, you are welcome to submit your deer to a USDA-approved laboratory for CWD testing. And you can find the instructions and laboratory contact information, as well as information on our current surveillance strategy at michigan.gov/CWD and click on the For Hunters heading. Now, some areas of the state have strategic CWD sampling goals this year and will have available CWD testing. To find those check stations and drop box schedules and availability for your area, please visit michigan.gov/deer check. Now, as we zip this segment to a close, remember, if you have questions about wildlife or hunting, you can call 517-284-WILD or you can email us at dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov. Your question might be featured on our next mailbag.
The DNR is on a mission to protect forests for a lifetime and generations to come. How? With forest management practices that contribute to clean water, help new forests grow after cutting, and allow all kinds of plants and animals to thrive. Why? Because healthy forests can slow climate change by absorbing carbon, and because sustainable forestry preserves the health and beauty of our state and improves our future. Learn more at michigan.gov/forestsforalifetime.
Now is your opportunity to win a Wild Talk podcast mug. As a thank you to our listeners, we'll be giving away a mug or two every episode.
Our September mug winners are Carrie DeHart and Andrew Pick. Congratulations, Carrie and Andrew. You will want to check your email as we'll be getting in touch with you soon. They answered the question, what is amplexus? Amplexus is the mating position of frogs and toads in which the male clasps the female prior to copulation.
To be entered into the drawing this month, test your wildlife knowledge and answer our quiz question. Name a bird in Michigan that feeds its young milk. And you can't see me, but I'm using air quotes around the word milk. No clues this time. I know you all are smart. Figure it out.
Well, once you've figured it out, email your name and the answer to us at dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov to be entered for a chance to win a mug. Be sure to include the subject line as mug me and submit your answers by October 15th. We'll announce the winners and the answer on next month's podcast, so be sure to listen in to see if you've won and for the next quiz question.
Good luck, everybody. Now back to the show.
I'm so glad we've been having a spooktacular episode so far, because last night I just dug through my holiday decorations and found my Halloween stuff, and I've pulled out, I think there's 4 totes now of various pumpkins and skeletons and creepy things, and I love Halloween. I especially love decorating for them, and so that is what is going to consume my next weekend. How about you, Hannah? Do you like to put up Halloween decorations?
I do. I do enjoy putting up Halloween decorations. We get all the spooky window clings out. I'm sure most of our longtime listeners will know how much I love bats. And so there's always lots of bat paraphernalia around for Halloween. But we do usually also carve pumpkins for Halloween and put them out. So we'll see where the wind takes me this year for decorations. I'm not sure exactly what we'll do this year, but there will certainly be pumpkins involved.
And some of you other listeners may be putting up these kinds of decorations too. While you're putting them up this year, make sure to keep wildlife in mind and make your decorations as wildlife friendly as they can be. We've talked about food attractants in the past, and Halloween candy is no exception. Make sure you don't leave candy outside unattended, and don't leave wrappers around where hungry wildlife might try to eat it.
And don't forget about the pumpkins. Many animals would love to nibble on a pumpkin as a free snack. Last year, I had squirrels eating my pumpkins that we had carved and left out on the porch for decoration. So be mindful where you place the pumpkins as well if you don't want wildlife hanging out on your porch.
Last year, I had a possum find my pumpkins, which was fun to watch, but it was really hard to make it leave afterwards. If you're really into decorating for Halloween and you want to hang decorations like fake cobwebs and string lights, you'll also want to consider where and how you place those, as wildlife could become entangled in them. You might want to avoid decorations with dangling or edible-looking parts as well, or anything that has loops or circles. If the area is frequented by deer, you'll want to make sure none of these lights or other decorations are in their pathway, where a buck might get its antlers tangled or the deer's legs could be tangled in these decorations.
It's not something that I necessarily have thought about very closely before, but it's good to keep in mind because you never know who's going to be wandering through at night. And those fake cobwebs also, you know, keep in mind that those have the potential to entangle birds or bats if they're hung around trees or even maybe near lights that might attract insects and therefore bats and owls that eat the bugs. So just be mindful and consider the placement carefully. And if you do have any of these decorations outside in your yard, you know, be sure to keep an eye on them and check them.
A few years ago, we had strung up these really cool purple LED bulbs across our bushes, which was under a big picture window. And they must have attracted insects because not much later, there was a bat in the area. And after a bit of time, it ran into the window because it must have been seeking out its supper. But it did fall to the ground and we just left it alone. Unfortunately, it was gone by the morning, but we have not since put up the purple spooky lights.
Finally, since you might be out walking or driving at dusk and into the early evening, be mindful and keep an eye out for wildlife that might also be active during this time frame.
We hope that everyone has a safe and spooky time this October. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wild Talk Podcast. And we will see you back here in November.
This has been the Wild Talk Podcast, your monthly podcast airing the first of each month and offering insights into the world of wildlife across the state of Michigan. You can reach the Wildlife Division at 517-284-9453 or dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov.